on the morning of September the 11th, another researcher called me and said that he had seen the news that this plane flew into this tower in New York. And he works also locally at Dulles Airport. Like, he's in the Democratic Party there, and he works on a committee that decides stuff about the airport and the airlines in that area. So he knew that it was completely off base that a commercial plane would be anywhere near these buildings. Mm-hmm. He knew right then that something was really terribly wrong. And in the course of explaining that to me, the second plane hit. And then both of us immediately knew, and anybody, you know, in any position, you know, of control had to know, that coincidence theory and accident theory are out the window at that point. These are planes being used as weapons. That's not a totally unknown scenario to them, even for the group that they're now blaming, the Al-Qaeda, because there were incidents in which planes in the Soviet Union and planes in Chechnya and a plane in Paris did the same thing. In other words, planes had earlier attacked buildings, and there was even an incident, you may remember, where a small Piper plane flew into the front of the White House in the Clinton years. And when it did fly in front of the White House, they put in the Washington Post that they built a surface-to-air missile port on the front lawn and put bushes around it so that they could protect the White House. Well, I grew up in a Pentagon family, so in the 50s when I would go into the Pentagon, my parents would take me in there. They'd usually drop me off at the library because I liked to read, so I found out a lot of interesting stuff that I couldn't get in the public library. But then they'd take me to lunch out in the central courtyard of the Pentagon, a sort of hole in the middle. And in the 1950s, my father pointed out to me surface-to-air missile ports that they had in the 50s in the central courtyard of the Pentagon for its protection. When I organized the Day Without the Pentagon demonstration in the mid-90s, when you do a demonstration in D.C., if you want to get it permitted, you have to deal with a lot of agencies, because D.C. is not just a city. It has city officials. Then it has all these federal cops that are around the buildings. Then it has special police for special buildings. Then it has park police. It's also a military district. And then it has special police in the transportation system. So we were going to have a march going from the National Cemetery down to the Pentagon, about a mile. And we came to the room to negotiate the permit. There were 16 different agencies represented there, of all the different kind of police that had to deal with us to walk 1 mile from the National, okay. And the head of Pentagon security took me for a tour inside the Pentagon. Of course, I'd seen a lot of the Pentagon, but he even took me into areas my mother never took me into. Took me through the area where the Joint Chiefs work and past their cafeteria, like their little dining room where they eat and, you know, all this stuff. And then took me outside and showed me. He said, well, your demonstration here is going to be filmed. And he pointed up to these cameras on the building, and I said, well, do you think we could get a copy? and then he said that they not only have them pointing down, but they have cameras looking in the sky, and they have radar that looks in the sky, and the building's protected. One of the questions they asked at that meeting was, are there going to be any Muslims at your demonstration? And we said, yeah, we work with people in the Muslim community, and Islamic faith, and people that are for peace, and so, yeah, we're going to have, probably have some of those folks at the demonstration. Why are you asking? Well, they claim that, and this is 1996 or so, they claim that we couldn't come up near the steps of the Pentagon because they were in a Delta alert, because they were getting almost daily, they claimed, terrorist threats from Muslims that they were going to blow up the building. Okay? So the reason I'm pointing these things out to you is that this is not like Pearl Harbor, surprise attack, nobody could see it coming. Even then, they actually did know it was coming. They did break the East Wing Code, and they knew that the attack was coming to Pearl, and they stepped back and let it happen. So September the 11th, okay, the first plane into the first tower. I mean, by 8:25, NORAD knows that four planes have been hijacked, at least four, which is unprecedented, all at once. There's nothing in the news. I mean, if one large commercial airliner goes off course, even without being hijacked, it usually hits the news pretty quick. If four are hijacked, but Katie Couric was sitting there when the first plane hit, saying, looking at a picture of the smoking building and saying, there must have been an explosion inside the building of some kind. And it wasn't for like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, and people called in. One guy called from the Holland Tunnel, said he saw an airplane wheel bounce down the tunnel next to his car, and somebody else had actually seen the plane fly in the building. So then finally they started saying, you know, well, it must have been a plane hit the building, or was it off course? And then boom, the second plane hits, you know, into the second building. So it's not being announced in the news, but by 8:25, NORAD and the National Military Reconnaissance, they know. And even though the planes are out of communication, they have their transponders off, it doesn't mean you can't see them on the radar. I mean, they know where they are. So you could say, okay, in a hijacking situation up till September the 11th, you go along because you want to try to save the lives. So the person hijacks the plane, they want to go to Cuba, so you fly to Cuba, you land the plane, you negotiate something, and you try to get out with as many people alive as you can. So you can explain it as a surprise in that sense up to a point. So maybe the first plane hits and they don't really know what's going on, but by the time the second plane hits, you have to know that this is planes being used as weapons. Not only that, but they were getting warnings from other intelligence agencies from other countries in the weeks prior that some major event was going to happen. They even were pegging the date at the time. There were military bases that went on alert September 10th. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle that Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, was told by his security people not to get on a plane that day. And there's some other instances of people internationally being told not to ride planes. Okay, so somebody knew it was coming beforehand, but even if you say, okay, they didn't know until the second plane hit, when the second plane hits, that's the key, and you've got two that are still up in the air, and you know that this was not a normal hijacking situation, you've got to do something about it. According to the press, moments after the second plane, which is 9:05, hits into the second tower, Bush and Cheney speak to each other, and they come to a decision to give a formal shoot-down order. So now you've only got the normal intercept process, but you've got a shoot-down order on these planes if need be. So you have your right, the right to defend yourself against them from presidential authority. And that goes out to the military, and they're tracking these planes. So I went downstairs after I got the call and second plane hit, and I turned on the local TV to see what was happening. And the local news on Channel 8 reported that there was a plane that had turned around in Ohio and it was headed to Washington, D.C. It was on the local news that the plane was coming. And then it was on the news that they were evacuating the White House, they were evacuating the Capitol, they were evacuating the Pentagon. And I kept watching the news to see what was going to happen. And the next, you know, 20, 25 minutes passed, and then whoomp, this big explosion goes off, and my windows shake, you know, and the thing has hit the Pentagon. Well, that area in there is the most restricted airspace in the country, and it has been for a very long time. Commercial pilots complain that they have to make these banking turns to go up and down the Potomac when they take off, and that it's not, you know, that it's somewhat dangerous to do that, but they won't change the rules because they don't want any plane flying in there over the Pentagon or the Capitol or the White House or the Congress or the monuments. Now, as a kid growing up in D.C., I saw instances where on a normal day, no big emergency going on, a commercial aircraft or a small plane would fly off course and come into that airspace. And almost immediately, helicopters would go up, intercept planes would go up, and it would get chased out of the airspace. So it's a militarily defended airspace. On top of that, they've got ground defense. And then they know for almost 40 minutes after this plane turns around that it's coming to D.C. And what happens? Absolutely nothing, except that two fighter planes are put up 130 miles away at Langley Air Force Base to intercept. They get there 5 minutes after the incident has happened. Well, they have F-16s and F-18s right where I live, Andrews Air Force Base, Anacostia Naval Air Station, Air National Guard. They defend that area. They're right there. They're right across the river from the Pentagon. They know 130 miles, they're barely 130 yards, you know, and they don't put up anything. And they have 40 minutes. I mean, you're not talking about like a guy has to be sitting there on the tarmac. If you can't get a plane up in 40 minutes to defend something, you haven't got a defense anyway. So either you've got to conclude that the $13 trillion that we, since the end of World War II, that we put into defense and intelligence in this country went into somebody's pocket and did absolutely nothing, and that you've got a Pentagon that can't defend itself, so how the hell can it defend you? Or you've got a stand-down situation where there was a decision made that this was coming and they were going to let it come. But there's absolutely no explaining what happened in Washington, D.C. on September the 11th, given the equipment that they had and the ability that they had to do something about that plane. And that plane came into the restricted airspace. It flew over the White House. No surface-to-air missile there. It flew over the Capitol. It looped around a second time. And then it took a 270-degree looping turn and flew at the so low it was knocking off lampposts into a side of the Pentagon. Well, it didn't have to go 270 degrees out of its way to hit that side of the Pentagon. All five sides of the Pentagon are open. It had a closer side. It went almost 360 degrees around. Why did it do that? And it went to the side where there wasn't anybody working, to the side of the Pentagon where even back in the 90s when I went there, they were doing construction and had been doing construction for years, and they had all these empty offices. So the dead in D.C., the people in the planes and the construction crews outside number much larger than the people who are actually killed inside the Pentagon itself, because that was an empty area. So this plane is going way the hell out of its way to hit the empty side. In the same way that I would argue that planning the operation in New York to hit the buildings at 8:43 instead of 9:43, when you'd had 50,000 people in there, is a plan that meant to not that it wouldn't kill anybody, but it was meant to minimize the number of deaths that were involved in the incident. There was a report not long ago in the Post that there was a special secure office that was working on counterterrorism in that section of the building that was decimated by the plane. Although it was secret enough that nobody outside the building could have known that it was there. But whoever did the planning for this did it on a level of tremendous sophistication. You cannot go to a flight training school, fly a Cessna plane, and use a flight simulator and figure out how to hit a building which is not as wide across as a landing strip, going 550 miles an hour and banking into the building. You talk to any honest pilot, they will tell you that you have to be a very experienced military or civilian pilot to do anything like that. You don't learn that at a puddle jumper school. And these planes are not like controlling a little Cessna. Flying them is, you know, it's difficult. Also, you have to ask the question, if they turned off the transponders and stopped communicating with ground, how did they get the planes from Ohio, from Pennsylvania, and the places where they were, back to these particular buildings that they wanted to hit? What was guiding them back? Who were they in contact with? How did they do the navigation? Not just to get to a city, but to get to a particular area where they wanted, and get there where they're boosting their speed in the last few minutes up to like 550, 600 miles an hour to go into these buildings. It took off from Dulles and turned around in Ohio. It's normally a Dulles to LAX flight. It's flight number 77.
So it got all the way up to Ohio.
In fact, a very good friend of mine and fellow researcher into the Kennedy assassination stuff is a flight attendant on that flight who was, you know, by grace of whatever, taking care of her sick father that day and wasn't on the flight crew, but she lost all of her friends and, you know, at work and the people that she knew. And wow, that was her regular daily flight. The minute I heard it was that flight, I thought, oh my God, you know, but found out she wasn't on it. But yeah, it went out of Dulles and then turned around in Ohio and came back to D.C. But it didn't go out of National, it didn't go out of the D.C. airport, it went out of Dulles, which is out like 30 miles out in Virginia. It was a sophisticated military covert operation. It was sophisticated enough that it has to have been planned at a state level. It was not planned by some little group communicating surreptitiously by some guy in a cell phone in a cave. And I mean, it was sophisticated. Timing was sophisticated, and then how it was responded to raises questions. When you do a covert operation, you spend more time and money on the cover story than you do on the actual mechanics of the event. The mechanical people is going to be about a third of the people that are busy with the cover story. Part of covert operation cover stories is usually plausible deniability, or what I call false sponsorship. And I learned this from working on the political assassinations, which were also military covert operations. So if you want to set somebody up, part of it is you want a false sponsor, you might create a legend for the person using doubles. So like in the Kennedy assassination, an Oswald double went to a firing range 2 months before the assassination, started shooting at the other guy's target. When the other guy complained, he said, "Hell with you, I'm Lee Harvey Oswald, remember my name." Well, sure enough, he did. And so then when, Oswald is set up as the patsy, this guy comes forward, "I remember him. He was there shooting at my target." That way you prove that Oswald was having firing practice, okay. Another example in those assassinations is James Earl Ray supposedly shooting Martin Luther King. The main evidence that tracked them back to Ray was a rifle and some other things that belonged to Ray, a prison radio, wrapped up in a bundle that the police found outside on the sidewalk, outside the rooming house from which Ray is supposed to have done the shooting. The bundle, according to the guy that ran the little amusement area, it's like a pinball store, like they call it Kniep's Amusement, in this area, saw the bundle dropped off by someone 5 minutes before King was shot. And the rifle's not really the murder weapon, and that's been proven out by Ray's subsequent trial before he died and other ballistics work. But it's not the rifle, but it links Ray to the killing. And it leads the police by the nose to this phony evidence to create Ray as the sponsor, the false sponsorship. That parallels to me to several things in the 9/11. Most of these people that got on the planes, we were given 19 names right away, even though there was some confusion about whether the people were on the airlines at first. There were some airline manifests released without any Arab names on them, but they were also missing 5 or 6 names on each list. But I was able to confirm through my flight attendant friend and people that she knows that some of the people actually pictured were on the plane, got on the plane, because there's ground crews that take tickets or go on and count the people on the planes, but they don't actually go with the plane. So there were people involved in the incident that actually saw some of the people, at least on Flight 77, were the same that were pictured. But when they put out the pictures and the names of the first 19 people, within a short period of time, Saudi Arabia and Egypt brought forward the fact that 7 of the 19 people that were named and pictured were actually living in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, 5 in Saudi and 2 in Egypt, who had, that was their name, that was their photograph, but they had nothing to do with the incident and were not aboard the plane. So you have use of false ID, at least on some of these people. Then you have a background on these people that, as far as I could tell, these were people who were not laying very low. I mean, they were sort of doing what the Oswald double was doing. There was a woman out in Langley, Virginia, which is the bedroom community that was built around the CIA. And all the CIA employees live in these little bungalows. 4 of these guys move in a bungalow there and made so much trouble in the neighborhood that the woman called the CIA about them and then complained that nothing was done. Other ones of them were on FBI alert lists. One guy got called into the FBI because he went to his airline trainer and said, "I don't care about landing and taking off, I just want to know how to fly the airplane." And that concerned the trainer enough that he called the FBI. Well, say, I mean, either you got to think Keystone terrorists or something else is going on. Somebody's planting a legend, somebody's making sure they're noticed. Some of these guys were on FBI alert lists, and they were making trouble. But the main incident was the first incident that they claim led them to these people, and it was at Logan Airport. And there was a guy at Logan Airport, this was the report in the press anyway, who had called the FBI after the incident when he landed out on the West Coast. He had taken a different plane out of Logan. But on his way there, parking the car, he said that he had encountered 4 Arabs in an automobile and that they had had a road rage argument with him over the parking space. And then hearing that one of the planes had been hijacked in Logan, He called the FBI thinking, well, you know, maybe these guys are involved. And then they said, yes, indeed, the car was rented by these four guys coming down from Canada. And in that car, they said that they found, well, it was at different points they found different things, so I don't know, you know. But the initial report was they found a Koran in the trunk, and they found a flight manual for that particular aircraft written in Arabic. Okay, and that to me was like the bundle for James Earl Ray. It was like lead them by the nose. Now, I don't know if the road rage argument actually took place. It could be that the guy that led the FBI there is part of the game. You see, so he's got a cover story for why he wants to lead them to this car. But if you went to the trouble of getting a flight manual in Arabic for that kind of plane, would you be cramming the last 15 minutes in the car, or would you take it on the plane with you? Who's going to be able to read it anyway, and what's the difference? You see? So I don't see why would you leave the evidence back in the car any more than James Earl Ray would have dropped his rifle after shooting Dr. Martin Luther King. So it made me suspicious that there was false sponsorship. And I still am suspicious because I believe that even mechanically, if you can show that the operation was carried out by Al-Qaeda elements and bin Laden as some sort of a mastermind in it, that doesn't tell you who did this. The reason it doesn't tell you who did this is bin Laden himself. Because bin Laden, from a very rich Saudi family, has had ongoing relations with the Saudi royal family as well as Saudi intelligence. He also has relations with Pakistani intelligence. And the chief guy for Pakistani intelligence who funneled money to him, including CIA money to him, got dumped out of the Pakistani intelligence in October after this incident for being too close to bin Laden, and because it was embarrassing him what was coming out. And the triggering incident for him getting kicked out of Pakistani intelligence finally was that it became known that he had given $100,000 in August to Muhammad Atta, who's one of the guys named as the mastermind of the incident. So here's a guy that was funding Atta directly. He had been funneling money to bin Laden. So they said, you know, no more, you're out. And he's taken off, but none of the underlings are taken off, just the top head of the agency. I mean, the Pakistani intelligence has been working with bin Laden for many, many years. Well, that guy who was fired in October was on September the 4th in the United States. He was at Langley meeting with the CIA. He was at the State Department meeting with Richard Armitage. Do you remember that name? That's part of the Iran-Contra. And Ollie North's group. There's a Sarasota paper, interestingly enough, that says that Muhammad Atta, in Sarasota, stayed in the house of one of the Iran-Contra pilots. Didn't get national news, but these guys are a little too close to home for me. I mean, and they're a little too visible. So you got Pakistani intelligence, Saudi intelligence, and CIA, which originally trained and armed and equipped the group around bin Laden. And then the final clicker for me, once I started doing the research, was Times of India in July of last year reported that Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, was in India, he was in Pakistan, he was in Tajikistan, he was in Uzbekistan, in all the surrounding countries in July, telling the leaders of those countries that in mid-October, the United States was going to militarily intervene in Afghanistan and get rid of the Taliban. This is July, not September, July. You see? Because they plan the wars in advance. And they have a purpose for the war that has nothing to do with September the 11th. It has nothing to do with fighting terrorism.
The U.S. should be moving alone on a war if they come out the day. You've got oil in the Caspian Sea that's got to get to India and China.
Mm-hmm. Well, they project by 2050 that the oil in the Caspian Sea region will be 80% of the world oil. And if you have an oil-dependent economy, and energy dependent, and on the profits of that, and that's what monopolizes, then you're going to want to control the sources of oil and where it is. You don't have to have an oil-dependent economy. The United States is 4% of the world's population, and it consumes about 65% of the oil. What most people don't know is that 65% of that amount in 1985 and projected to 80 to 85% by this century would be military use. What that means is that we're going abroad fighting wars to have enough oil to be able to fight the wars, to protect the oil. And Schwarzkopf revealed, Norman Jr., he revealed at a Gulf War celebration with Bush Sr. and some others at Texas A&M University at the end of last year, they were celebrating the great victory of the Gulf War, and he started ticking off how much it took, how many tanks, how many planes, and he mentioned how much oil. 3.5 billion gallons of oil to fight the Gulf War. Well, that's almost more oil than there is available in Kuwait, you see. So it's kind of a perverse logic, but it's also profit at the bottom line. And the profits at both ends, where you use the oil, sell the oil to the military, sell the oil to us, and you keep it going. So that's a piece. The other piece is that 80% of the world opium is coming out of Afghanistan, which is worth more than oil or gold, you know. And the people that are coming in now, the original firm that wanted, what they wanted, there was this firm called Unocal, this corporation, and they cut a deal in the late 90s with both the Northern Alliance and the Taliban to bring a pipeline from the Caspian region down into the Persian Sea. The reason they want to bring these pipelines down to the sea is that then the oil gets put onto a tanker, the tanker goes out into the middle of the ocean, and then ports bid for the tanker to come and land at their port, and the highest bidder gets it. That's how they artificially inflate the price of the oil. The other problem that we have, and part of the reason we're fighting, is not so much that we need the oil, it's to make sure that Japan and Germany don't get the oil. Because the fascists were very brilliant, if you think about it. After the end of World War II, their two previous enemies, the Soviet Union and the United States, were locked into a Cold War and an arms race. And Bobby Inman, former director of CIA, in a public forum where I questioned him about this, admitted to me that the architects of that Cold War were hundreds of Nazi spies that were brought into the United States to form the CIA under Reinhard Gehlen. And so they came in saying, oh, we're your friend now because we're against your enemy. And they pitted us against the Soviet Union, and we gutted our industrial base and our economy funding that arms race, and so did the Soviet Union. So the two former enemies are decimated. Meanwhile, Japan and Germany are demilitarized, and they build their industrial base, and even though they're much smaller countries, they become capitalist competitors with the United States. The only limit is that they don't have any oil source. You see, what led to Pearl Harbor was that the United States boycotted any oil from getting to Japan, and then the Japanese militarist class had the argument to say that that's an act of war and we have to attack the United States. Okay? And since then, we've been making sure that they get oil, but only at our price and at our conditions. The whole issue with Kuwait, the British knew it too, is it's a little wedge at the bottom of another big oil field that permits or doesn't permit the oil from getting to the sea. And so that's why you fight over these areas, but it's not just for our control of the oil. It's for where the oil is going to ultimately go and who's going to make the profit off of it. So the person that's been brought in now, well, the Taliban balked. That's what happened. The Taliban originally agreed the pipeline, then they balked. And so that's why they had to be eliminated, not because somebody cares about the rights of women. You have Bush jumping around about the rights of women in Afghanistan. For Christ's sake, women had full participation in the society before we put these reactionary mujahideen in to throw out the secular Soviet government. The women were in a good position. They were getting educated, and they were, you know. So we create the conditions that oppress them and then go in, you know, 20 years later, take them off and, you know, tip our hat as if we've done some favor to them. I mean, the ironies of the situation are just too deep whenever you start in, because they're always lying to you, you know, from the beginning to the end. You know, and the common thing now on the left, or some of the left at least, is to say that this is blowback, which means it's an unintended consequence of an earlier intelligence operation or something that comes out of it you don't intend. And that at some point bin Laden, even though he was a creature of the CIA and funded by the CIA, he turned tail and now he's the big enemy of the United States. I don't buy it. I don't buy it for a number of reasons, but one of them is that the CIA station chief in Abu Dhabi was meeting as late as August with bin Laden in a hospital. You know, the Pakistani intelligence funding kept going through to him after that period. And I said at the beginning, they're not going to catch bin Laden. They're not going to kill bin Laden or drag bin Laden to justice, because he's more used to them as a will-o'-the-wisp that can move from country to country than he is dead. In the same way that I never believed that there were people really trying to kill Castro, who then got out of control and killed Kennedy. I think this whole thing about poison cigars, you know, and shellfish toxin and blah, blah, was some late night fantasy stuff that the CIA put up. But when they asked Giancana and Marcello and the mob guys about it in the congressional hearings, they were closed at the time, but Regano, their attorney, revealed that he came out of that hearing and he said to Marcello, what did they want to know? He said, they want to know if we were trying to kill Castro. I said, what did you tell him? He said, I told him the truth. We weren't trying to kill Castro. And I don't believe they were. Because if they can kill Kennedy, they can sure as hell kill Castro, can't they? I mean, if they can kill the President of the United States, they can't kill the President of a little tiny island? Because he said, no, because having Castro there, the great threat 90 miles from our shores, the communist menace, you know, was more use to them than not, you know. And in fact, if you go back and look at it, there was a section of the mob that wanted to put Prio Sakaris into Cuba, and there was a section of the CIA that wanted to put Castro in. And the CIA was running guns to Castro, which doesn't say that he was dead, no revolutionary politics. In fact, he came to the United States for help after he got in, if you remember, and then was turned down, and then started to go, you know, further in the other direction. But they put him in, and in fact, two of the people that ran guns to Castro in Cuba for the CIA were a guy named McWillie and another guy named Jack Ruby. So, they know, in the broader picture, what's going to come, and they know when it's useful to create an enemy. But Saddam Hussein didn't come to power on his own. He had help through U.S. intelligence, and he more than bin Laden got in his position without that help. And they may become expendable to them at some point. I don't say they won't kill their own. They will, but when you go into these situations, you know, and they want you to talk about terrorism, I would bet you that 85% of the people that consider themselves terrorists in the world were trained and armed and equipped by the CIA. Because it's useful to them at different points to have people as enemies. I mean, when the Soviet Union's gone, why do we need such a big military? Why can't we have a peace dividend? Well, it's those damn six terrorist groups. We've got to defend ourselves against them. We've got to build a fortress state. We have to have a bigger military and a bigger CIA. And besides that, the CIA doesn't have enough power because Frank Church stripped them, shackled them, you know, and they can't assassinate anybody anymore. You know, and the thing that was funny to me was all these congressmen started standing up and saying that, and then CNN went over and interviewed a CIA analyst at Langley. That was the first week, like in the first few days. And this Langley guy says, well, you know, they're kind of misdirected. We don't need that legal authority. And they don't. Not only don't they need it, they don't want it. Because if you go to the hitman and you say, hey, we're going to make you legal, he's going to say, the hell with that, you're going to blow my cover. He said, at least now I've got plausible deniability. If you make it legal for me to kill people, everybody that gets killed, they're going to blame me. So it's better to have a law on the books, at least, that says I can't do it, and then let me go ahead and do it, than the other way around, you see.
I think the thing about this, now we have a security threat all over the United States, and it's just...
We sure do. It's called George Bush.
Well, I mean, legally, it's an excuse for constricting information.
Absolutely.
So people didn't know anything before.
Yeah.
They weren't educated, and now they're going to be even less educated and even have less information. We had a lot of useful stuff posted on the web that's going to be pulled, and people are going to be intimidated to ask. They won't be comfortable asking questions. They won't be comfortable looking for information, and they're going to be, it's going to be back like the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, McCarthyism, maybe worse.
Well, that's certainly what they want. I mean, they don't want people to ask questions. You're either for us or against us. You know, the Earth Liberation Front is a terrorist organization. You know, I've got a little sticker somebody gave me at the end of September. It's got the Eagle seal on it, and it says Office of Homeland Security, and it says, hey, you look like a terrorist. You know, they want us all to distrust each other, and of course they're going to do what they can. I mean, they're already interfering with the internet stuff. Bush has called for more secrecy in everything that they do.
Yeah.
They want secret evidence, secret trials. They don't want the Freedom of Information Act to work. They said that if you sue in court for freedom of information, they're going to bring the full weight of the Justice Department. But all that tells me is that we've got our work cut out for us. I mean, this is the time when you have to have democracy. Exercising democracy between wars would be like being a vegetarian between meals. This is when democracy counts. And it's also a time when we have the opportunity, we have enough knowledge to know. We may not know every secret they want us to know, but there's a great deal more public skepticism and it's going to grow because they aren't making too many people happy with all this. They're making a few people at the top very happy. They're paying the rich off with these tax cuts, and the rich get to loan them money for the deficits, and the arms makers are getting money. But there's a recession on, and it's getting worse and worse every day. Okay, and that was already happening before September the 11th. There was a worldwide economic slump, and Bush was in trouble. If you remember, he couldn't get his domestic agenda through. And that's why I said, I went down to the laundromat and I started talking to a guy after the anthrax envelopes came in, and I said, tell me something. I said, maybe I'm confused. Which political party is in the White House? He said, Republican. I said, which political party is carrying on this war? He said, Republican. I said, which political party's leaders got these anthrax envelopes? He said, the Democrats. I said, that mean anything to you? The two main Democratic opponents of Bush's domestic agenda get the anthrax envelopes? I mean, again, we've got Keystone terrorists or some other kind of game. You know, can't they even figure out who their own enemy is? And now we're at the point where there was a thing in the newspaper that said the FBI's main suspect in the anthrax is the CIA. And if that isn't a split in the ruling class, I don't know what is.
Where was that book?
It was in the New York Times. Well, they're looking for a scientist, all right. The trouble was they got a scientist who actually did the scientific analysis, and they found out, number one, that the strain genetically is Ames strain.
Right.
The trouble is they can't get it back to the batch, because in October, after the incident broke, the FBI called the Ames laboratories out in Iowa, and they had a 70-year archive of all the strains of anthrax that had ever existed, and they maintained an archive for 70 years, and then the FBI said, destroy it. And they gave them the green light, and they wiped out 70 years, so you can't go back and actually trace the genetical mutation that this is. But they do know that it's Ames strain, so it's from the US, and secondly, they know it's got no aluminum derivative stuff in it, which means it isn't Iraq, because that's the way they weaponize, and it isn't weaponized the way the Russians weaponize it, so now it's down to Fort Detrick. It's American anthrax, and it was created at Fort Detrick. That's what the science shows us. Now, there was one letter written in trying to blame some Arab scientist that worked.
I thought they were blaming like a U.S. laboratory scientist.
Yeah, he is, but he's Arabic.
Oh, that's
see, so they sent it. This damn Arab did it. But the letter has similar handwriting to the anthrax letters, so it's likely, you know, and even they have to admit that this is just, you know, false sponsorship again, you see. But, I mean, then there hasn't been a word since I saw that article, really. I mean, first there was the lone nut description put out, you know, must be a young male, that's, you know, the testosterone stuff. And then that disappeared, and then they said it was the CIA, and I haven't heard word one since. I mean, where's the investigation gone since then, you know? But it stymied them, because it's an internal job. And then, of course, I mean, they get benefits, you know, they can convince people up to a point, but they didn't give people any options, you know. You get a poll, and I don't know who's polled. Has anybody in here ever been polled? I mean, I can't ever find anybody in huge audiences that ever been polled, but they poll somebody.
Oh,
you got polled.
On the telephone, and I had to give answers different than what they wanted. You know, say, who are you going to vote for, Republican or Democrat? Bullshit, I don't agree.
I'm going to vote for Republican. Yeah. So you don't fit the questions. There you go. Right. Well, and of course the question. I'm not going to tell you. Why the hell are you asking me? I mean, of course the questions do it, but I mean, I don't think it's all that random. But they show you a poll that says, do you want to take military action in the wake of it? And you get 95% or something according to this poll. But even there, then they ask a second question, what about if it involves massive civilian deaths? What about if it involves American troops coming home, body bags in large numbers? Then, whoop, down it goes. I mean, you know, then you're down to like 65%.
Depression.
Yeah, right. Well, they don't, they're not going to ask that, but that's of course, you know. But then they don't even ask them, you know, should we do a military attack and or something else? They don't give them any alternative. So the alternative is either do a military attack or do nothing. Given those two, I'll take the military attack. You know, finally they did some polls where they asked, you know, what about an international tribunal and treat it as a, you know, a crime and use a rule of law, and then 65% want to do that. 80% on the international polls want an international tribunal. So they don't have as much support, you know, as you might think. I mean, I know right afterwards a lot of like American flags cropped up, but what I saw in D.C. anyway was a lot of the people with American flags in the cars were poor blacks, poor Hispanics, and Afghani or Arab taxi drivers, you know, basically wrapping the flag on there to say, don't blame me. And then the other piece of that is that a lot of people, it's not so much that they're pro-war as they're just afraid, and they want to feel they're part of a larger group that they're going to protect them. So it's like, yeah, I'm an American too, and everybody's, you know, with, so you're scared. But if you freeze everybody in fear and grief and rage, then of course you can get violence as the response. But if you move beyond that, as you have to in order to get any kind of closure to any kind of situation that's traumatic, then you start to come to some realization that you negotiate out other kinds of options, because retaliation is not going to get you what you think it's going to get you. You're not going to get the closure that you want. And so it says to me is that our responsibility is all the more to educate people, to give them functional alternatives, you know, and not to give them alternatives in a time of crisis is to manipulate them.
And I think you're really right about it being different from the 50s in the sense that we are in a deep economic crisis now. The economy's not expanding anymore. We've had several years of it in radicalization in society in terms of the anti-globalization.
Yeah. I think it already is.
Right.
No, I think you'll find that the match. And even if it's not the case, I mean, I started out in 1964 with three people at an information table, you know, and maybe 4 or 5% of the country even knowing where Vietnam was or asking anything about it, you know. And 4 years later, we had 85% of the American public convinced that it was a bad war. So I mean, you don't need to despair, but what you do need to do is somehow create a situation where it goes beyond this issue of the particular war that you're responding to how are we going to establish a democratic mechanism in this society? Because our problem is not that everybody's so ignorant or not even that everybody isn't opposed, but you can be knowledgeable and you can be opposed and you can think it's all wrong, but where's the mechanism to do anything about it? And if you think, I mean, obviously it doesn't rest in these political parties, to me. Even the alternative political parties, it doesn't rest there. Parties, according to Jefferson, and I think he's right, in Washington too, are inimical to democracy. Jefferson said that there can, in any society, only be two parties, no matter what they call themselves. Parties who want to take power from the hands of the people and accrue it into the hands of the few, and he called those the aristocrats. And he said, the others want to take power away from the few and give it into the hands of the people as a whole, and he called those Democrats. And he said, rightly so, that if you establish a democratic society, you don't need a democratic party. Washington said in his last speech that policies belong to the people as a whole. And he said that in order to make those decisions as a whole, parties got in the way because parties put those decisions back in the hands of a few. You see? And that is very basic, but I mean, if you want a real democracy, and a democracy to me is a situation where all the people that are affected by a decision make that decision. And it has to be participatory because representative democracy dates to the 1700s and the technology that they had when they made up the Constitution. What technology did they have? They didn't have a radio, they didn't have a TV, they didn't have instant communication or instant travel, they had a wagon or a horse. And they put somebody on the wagon and a horse, and they sent them 200 miles off to a meeting in Philadelphia or New York, and they represented them because that's all they could do. Somebody was there to give the local point of view and then bring back the report on what happened, and probably you picked the person that you liked the least and sent them out of town for a couple of months to get them off your back, and that was the representative. But, I mean, the fruit's a lot farther from the tree. That's a much smaller and much less complex society. How can 500 people represent 240 million people? And do they ever even try? Have you ever had an elected representative of the people come to you and say, hey, you're the people, what do you think? And if they did, would they get 100% or 95% to think the same? No. So then if they get a split populace on an issue, how can they then, with their one vote on the bill, represent anybody? I don't want to represent you. I don't want you to represent me. I don't think I could represent you. So what's the point? We have the technology from the time we had radio and any kind of mass communication distributed to have open and public debate on the airwaves about issues, about policies, and to make those decisions as a whole and to make them in an informed way. You see, Jefferson said that there's only one safe depository in a society for the powers of the society, and that's among the people themselves. You know, now I'm the first to admit, I mean, his vision is limited by his time. He doesn't see all people as people. You know, and we get smarter about that. Who knows, you know, should the human species survive for another 300 years or 1,000 years, you know, how they'll laugh at us and our limited consciousness. But that within that consciousness, he tried to define what would be liberation. What would it look like, at least for the people that he defined as people. So the people as a whole have to have that power. And he said, if you find them unable to exercise their discretion in a wholesome fashion, in other words, you don't trust the people or you think they'll make the wrong decision, the solution is not to take that power from them, but to inform their discretion. He said once that given a choice between a government without a newspaper or a newspaper without a government, he would always choose the latter. I said in one lecture a couple of years ago, that's because he never read the New York Post or the Washington Times. But what he meant by a newspaper was information flow. And that was more important to democratic process even than the mechanisms of the government that would carry it out. He didn't feel that the mechanisms that he envisioned would last forever or be good forever. He said, I wouldn't expect my children to wear a threadbare coat just because I like to put it on. He said, if I build a fort to protect my family from some external threat and the threat went away, I wouldn't expect them to remain in the fort. He even said that if I planted a tree with fruit that I meant for them to have, if they didn't like the fruit, I wouldn't force them to eat it. And he said that there had to be a revolution every 20 years, probably, to keep power from aggregating back into the hands of the few. Okay? But these are not lessons that we've paid attention to or followed. But they exist, and our responsibility, the same as in Jefferson's time, is to envision that liberation. The advantage we have over Jefferson is he's basically in a pre-industrial or, you know, just maybe the very scraping beginnings of the industrial age, you know, which is the transition from accumulation of wealth by just raw theft and power to accumulation of wealth by production. But still for a long period, although that curve goes up quick after the industrial age starts, you have scarcity. But now, as we transition out of the industrial age to the information age, you'll notice that most of the economy is around service, not around labor, you know, and production, because production, the technology has arced the curve up to the point that you don't need that much labor to produce the basic things that people need or want. Now, often those things don't get produced because it pays you more not to produce them using the same resource, and that's another question. You know, like there's enough arable land in every country in the world to feed the people that live there, given the current population, and even more, but they don't use the arable land primarily to grow food, to feed people. They grow cash crop, often for export, you know. But the resources are there, the technology is there. We've turned the corner in human history where we have surplus, and the capability is there with even less labor than we currently expend for everyone to be fed, everyone to be housed and clothed and live reasonable lives and have transportation and have communication, have gadgets and, you know, connections, entertainment, whatever it is that people want, and things that we haven't thought of yet. But we live instead in a world and in a growing market controlled by these corporations and the kind of society that we live in that doesn't focus on human needs but focuses instead on profits that aggregate into the hands of fewer and fewer people, so that under 2% of the world's population now control 85-90% of the resources effectively and the ability to produce. And because those systems don't need the labor, we're in the same position that they were at the end of the Weimar Republic in Germany. They had a leap forward in technological development. They had a devaluation of the currency. They had a tremendous concentration of wealth into the hands of the corporate few. Mussolini said that fascism should really be called corporatism. He said that it was the merging of the corporation and the state. And he said that corporatism plus reaction was the way he would define fascism. Okay. And so now we have this not only on a national level, but a global level, but in Germany, they came to that same point. And because the few at the top don't want to give up their relative advantage, their relative privilege, or their ability to create more profit, then labor, which isn't needed, becomes expendable. Even in the 1930s, the miners here in the United States were told to push the mules that pulled the carts out of the mine when it began to collapse in front of them. The reason for that was that they were told that it costs money to replace a mule. Okay? They were just the human capital, next down on the scale. They weren't the machine. Okay, it's kind of like Enron. Okay, you're just the trade. So we're in the same position as those people, or in Nazi Germany. When the labor becomes excessive, then it becomes Untermensch, useless eaters, taking up space, and therefore expendable. Then, depending on the biases of the society, particular groups are going to be picked out to go first. In Nazi Germany in 1936, it was the mental patients. 300,000 mental patients were killed in six special killing centers developed by the psychiatrists, where they came up with the idea of the gas chambers and the crematoria, and then those psychiatrists were brought to Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz and the broader Holocaust to do the technology of death. Well, that's right. I mean, we have larger methods, but the end result of going in that direction is genocide. And this system, worldwide genocide, and that's what this is creating. It's creating a situation where ultimately 20% would survive, perhaps, in some sort of technologically driven paradise, but the other 80% are expendable. And that's what we're really being asked to support in terms of this new war, this 10-year war that they're talking about, or now Cheney said a war that may not end in our lifetime, a war that may involve 60 countries, because September the 11th shifted, it was a paradigm shift, and it was global, and it shifted onto one side of the world all of the global corporations, the globalists, the neoliberal markets, what they call the free market, that are controlled by these global corporations, and the wannabes, China and Russia. September 12th, China jumped into the World Trade Organization. And Russia and Putin will line up. So you have all of that over on one side, controlled by the corporations, the IMF, and everything else. And then on the other side of the world, you have the underdeveloped countries and the pockets that remain of resistance within those neoliberal countries. And they become terrorists. That's what this article means. The people, you're either for us or against us. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. So, and I was saying that 5 years ago, that the framework of the debate in this country has shifted so far to the right that its parameters on the media are between an open fascist and a moderate conservative. That what used to be a liberal in the 60s is now what a commie was in the 50s. And that meant somebody like me that had a radical analysis must be a terrorist. I mean, I was saying that 5 years ago. Now they just, made it official.
There's also going to be increased competition, I think, between Europe, Japan, United States, too. I think that'll be developing.
Right. Well, you never have absolute hegemony, but I'm just saying they've lined them up as much as they can line them up, and then there is a friction because the U.S. wants to call the shots. And this is kind of our last bid for global hegemony. But now you've got on the other side this European Union that's just formed that, as an aggregate, is even bigger market than we are. And they have their agendas too, and there's elements in there ready to go along with us and other elements that aren't so cooperative. Okay. So my argument has never been, a lot of people call me a conspiracy theorist, and one of my responses to that is you can call me a conspiracy theorist if you want to call everybody else a coincidence theorist. Or now I've come up with a new term, conspiracy denier. It's kind of like a Holocaust denier, but I think if they use that with us, we should use that with them. But I don't believe that there's seven Illuminati in a room running human history. That's not my idea. I mean, Ishmael Reed says in Mumbo Jumbo that the real history of the world is a history of competing conspiracies. Because all human organizations have entropy. There's Young Turks, there's vying factions, and so there's a split here. The ruling class here is not monolithic. They used to balance the ticket. For every Kennedy, you'd have an LBJ. Now they don't. I mean, they have Clinton and Gore on one side, then they have Bush and Cheney on the other side, and they, you know, they fight back and forth that way. You can't assassinate one and get the other guy in now. You know, they cover that option, you know. Except the running joke in D.C. is if Cheney has a heart attack, Bush could become president. God forbid, you know. I mean, the problem isn't the emperor has no clothes. It really is the emperor has no brain. But nobody's got the guts to say it. He's become such a leader in this situation. Oh, a brilliant speech. I mean, he talks, it sounds like a 12-year-old describing a video game. There's the good guys and the evil guys, and we're going to get them, you know. Like, how are you supposed to listen to that and think that that's some kind of serious comment from a world leader in the, you know. God forbid, they used to worry about maniacs being at the button. I mean, you know, you've got them now. But at least he's not completely in charge. I mean, you can tell he's just, you know, doing what he's told to do and trying to learn to read from the prompter.
If you were to say Enron's but the tip of the iceberg, where would you go from that?
Well, I don't know. It depends on what the iceberg is. But, I mean, I think it's instructive that Unocal, this company that wanted to run the line down through Afghanistan and made the deal and then abandoned the deal when the Taliban pulled out, then they started building a pipeline to the west to just hit the northern tip of Afghanistan and go along with the Northern Alliance and take it over to another section. And that was Enron. So it may be that Enron's downfall is really a fight over the pipeline. Okay? It may also be that the Eastern establishment went down with the Twin Towers and all the Eastern banks, and now they're coming back at Bush at the other end. But scandals don't happen because of investigative reporting. And corporations don't fall for lack of somebody pulling the plug. I mean, you're having a little trouble on that level of a corporation. They can tax subsidize you. They can bring in some covert funds. I mean, somebody can do something if need be, but they let it collapse. In the same way that I couldn't figure out at first what the hell was going on with the election. Because I know that they can't let elections in this country come down to a vote. I mean, I've known that for years. How could they afford to? If they'll spend $10 million for who's going to be the president of Chile, what do you think they spend here? Where it counts. So they can't leave it up to us. It's like they make this whole structure of, you know, economic power, and then they say, okay, you guys decide. No, I mean, and they don't count the votes. They don't go up to absentee votes and recount the votes in elections. The elections are a script. They hand you these two candidates from these two political parties. You know, they have a framed debate to show you that they're not really the same party, you know. And the issues of that debate are chosen by them. No other candidates are allowed to come in. The news covers it, and then they start taking polls. And they tell you ahead of time who's going to win the election. Well, in a real democracy, what do you need a poll to tell you who's going to win the election except to influence who's going to win the election? And you actually get people here, well, I'm not going to waste my vote on a loser. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy if they counted the vote, you know. Then just in case, you know, you really get out of control and vote the other way and somehow they count it wrong, you know, and the wrong guy wins, they've always got the Electoral College to back them up, you know. But then there's a script that they follow on the night of the election. Before everybody even finishes voting, they have exit polls and they tell you who's going to win. And they count all the electoral votes up, and then NBC announces the winner. And then the other guy at some point stands up and concedes. Isn't that the script? It was all the time I grew up. So I'm watching along there, you know, and it's going by script, and Gore's going to concede. And then all of a sudden, Gore says, wait a minute, I'm not going to concede. I'm like, what the hell is going on? I mean, Gore is just as much a player as Bush is. You know, I knew that Bush would win the election from the minute that they said that Bush was the candidate. Because I live in D.C., and on the day of Clinton's inauguration, Poppy Bush, going out of town with a snarl on his face, said, I'll give him his term, then I'm coming back. Well, that was already, in my view, the third term that Bush had, because Bush, in my view, became president on March 31, 1981 with the shooting of Reagan by Hinckley. The Hinckley and Bush families are like this, economically and socially, for many, many years. So that's Bush, you know, and Reagan said, get me the demographics on that kid. I'm sure he figured out who shot him, you know. And then from then on, he's out watching movies at Camp David, and he's waving at the press under the helicopter, and Bush is running the country. So, I mean, he's already had a couple of terms, but that's not enough, you know, King George V. So, when they said Bush was going to run, I said, Bush is going to win. And then I got all these nervous Nellies. They were saying, I don't know, should I vote for Nader? Should I vote for Gore? Because I'm afraid if I vote for Nader, I'm going to vote for Bush. And I said, look, Bush is going to take the election. I said, if you want to vote, and you want to vote for Nader, just vote for Nader. I said, at this point, a vote for Gore is a vote for Bush. Don't you get it? I mean, Bush is going to win. I mean, I was saying that in a lecture in Philadelphia before the election. But sure enough, I mean, not only does he win, but they got to drag our nose through it. They lift up the petticoat and they say, look, we don't really even have elections here. Look at this. Ha ha. We disenfranchise these people over there. We don't count this vote. We throw those votes out. We got some military votes over here to save them at the last minute if we need it. You know, and it's all like, how could they? I mean, to me, it was as blatant as the Kennedy assassination. You know, we done already told you who won the election. Now set your whiny Democrat ass down and shut up. They're counting the votes. You know, it's not up to you. And they want us to know it. They want us to know that it's not up to us. So they're making it, they're taking the glove off the fist here in the United States. It's off the fist in other countries already. And we know we do it there already, but now they're doing it here at home. You know, so they show us, they pop the script open, and Gore goes along, he's quiet as a mouse now. You know, the Democrats asked for the wrong votes to be counted, and they could have won, you know. And, you know, it was all just a show. So the same way, it's the same way with all these scandals. The scandals are orchestrated by one part of the class, scandalizes the other part of a class when they're fighting. And for that moment, the window opens and we get to see in a little bit. You know, like this Monica Lewinsky thing, you know, which is to me like the new way you assassinate a president. You don't bullet him, it's too, you know, gauche and everybody will figure it out. So let's scandalize him out, you know, with a real crime. He was like screwing around on his wife, you know. There's the crimes of the ruling class, who they sleep with and what they put in their mouth, you know. We're really in trouble now, you know. I wish those were their crimes, you know. But we're supposed to get upset, you know, because not only did he do it, he lied about it. It used to be called a gentleman's lie when I grew up, you know. But he lied about it, you know, under oath. And I, you know, and there was jerks were saying this to me. He lied under oath. I said, they all lie under oath when they take the oath of office and say that they'll defend the Constitution. What are you upset about? So he was screwing one woman, right? Nixon was screwing the whole country. You know, but it's just like, this is supposed to be a scandal. I took a sign down to one of the anti-impeachment demonstrations that said, Republican morality? A high horse with no legs. I mean, it's the national sport in D.C. They all screw their interns, you know? What's new? But this is it, you know, Clinton's big scandal. But I mean, they embarrass him, they put him over the barrel. But nobody asked, except Hillary finally said there's a vast right-wing conspiracy. I wanted to take a sign down and said, yes, Hillary, there is a vast right-wing conspiracy. You know, and she said to the press, you guys should check the backgrounds of these people, and they don't do it. Who is Linda Tripp? Anybody know the background on Linda Tripp, the woman that got her to do the taping? She's GS-16 Army Intelligence. She's left over in the White House from the Bush era. She was the personal secretary in the Delta Force to Richard Secord from the Oliver North operations. That's the friend of little Monica Lewinsky, who then passes the tapes to who? Lucienne Goldberg, this woman. Whew. I mean, she goes back to World War II intelligence operations. Her husband, Arthur Goldberg, worked directly under a fellow named Ian Fleming from Navy Intelligence, who wrote the Bond books. And it's something that was created by British and U.S. intelligence called the North American Newspaper Alliance. And it was a cover to take spies and pose them as journalists and stick them under the door in countries, and also to plant disinformation stories around the world under the cover of a legitimate news gathering organization, NANA. The first two interviews with the defector Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union to prove his red worth are from two women who worked for NANA for Arthur Goldberg. So this is directly under Fleming. This one's been doing disinformation stories for years. She was the public relations agent for Mark Furman, for Christ's sake, the cop in the LAPD thing. A real nice character. They said, do you think the Clinton people are coming to get you? She said, if I thought they were coming to get me, I'd get out my deer rifle. If I said that, the Secret Service would be at my door. And she said, on national news, and they don't bother her. Okay? They don't come from no place. I mean, these are operations that they're pulling off, you know? They run a plane into the front of the White House. And I said, where's the Secret Service? Where's the radar? I wake up in the morning, a plane has come into the front of the White House. We don't know where it's from. We don't know who owns it. We don't know who the pilot is. He's dead. But not to worry. The president and his family are safe because we're remodeling the White House, and they're over at the Blair House. And I said, I'm glad there's no real terrorists. Because if there were, you've just told him you missed him over there. He's at the Blair House. The Blair House is where the Puerto Rican nationalists tried to attack and kill Truman. So that's message number one. And if that's not enough, then later in the day they announce on the news that Clinton's not going to change his plans for the evening and he and his wife are going to the Ford Theater. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? I mean, how many signals do you need? They can, if they can drive a plane into your bathroom window without anybody reacting, they can kill you. That's all. It's just a little message, you know. And there's no way that plane could have gotten in there without being seen. They said it was flying too low below the tree line and we couldn't see it on the radar. I said, oh, now I know how to take over Haiti. We get 100 guys with on psychiatric disability to VA. We put them in Piper Cubs, and there we go. We've got the whole country. Just got to fly below tree level. Well, wasn't it above tree level some at some point before it got down to tree level? It takes off in Baltimore. This guy, his son said later, this guy's living on 100% psychiatric disability on a VA ward. And his son said in an article, my dad's got keys to lots of planes. Put those two sentences together. And he goes to this Baltimore airport. He takes a plane that doesn't belong to him, and it flies off, and there's no alert. There goes another, and Harry, who he thinks in it? No alert, and he comes down into this restricted airspace. Well, then they had to start changing the story. First, they said it was too low. Then they said, no, it was on the radar, but it happened between 3 and 4 in the morning, and we don't look at the radar those hours. And then again, I said, I'm glad there's no real terrorists, you know. Between 3 and 4 in the morning, we don't guard the Capitol, you know. So that was how they missed him, you know. So it comes and he crashes into the thing, and there's no response. It's just that you have to look a little bit beyond the story. You have to look at one or two details. It's not that it's not out there, you can't figure it out. But when you have something like Enron happening, it has got to have to do with some division of the class. Somebody's moving the money. Somebody wants the same as. Now they've put in this new government in Afghanistan. Karzai, the guy that's heading it up, the moderate, do you know who he is? Do you know his background? He was an employee of Unocal, the pipeline company. The moderates that are coming in under him were named in the London Sunday Times 6 years ago as the major drug lords in the Northern Alliance. So they're the new opium trade for the country, you know. And of course they'll have a drug war so they can wipe out any opposition. You know, or somebody else that tries to compete, you know, we'll have an anti-narco like we're having in Colombia right now because we're worried about the narco-terrorists, you know. But really, I mean, who are the terrorists in this world? You had nothing to be scared about before September 11th and now you've got everything to be scared about? You exist in some little pocket of privilege here in the United States, you know? Were we terrorists in Nicaragua with the Contras? Was that terrorist? You can go to September the 8th and you can find out about a terrorist war that the United States was carrying on in Belarus in the old White Russia section that was being compared to the Contra war in its volume of terror. And they had funded 300 NGOs to take over the government and they were carrying on a terror war. That's September the 8th in the mainstream press. Does it feed into what? American support for Israel?
Getting people behind Israel.
Well, I mean, there's a long history of U.S. support for Israel and for Israeli support for other.
Now they want to take out Arafat.
Uh-huh. Well, but they also announced that they wanted to create a secular state for Palestine, you know, right before the September 11th stuff. So they're always manipulating the politics wherever they go. I mean, there's some people that try to argue that Israel is somehow a tail wagging the dog of the United States. I don't buy that. I think that there's long-standing connections between Israel and the United States and the intelligence agencies and everything else, but I don't think a country the size of Israel is telling the United States what to do or has some kind of ultimate control. But,
no,
yeah, I mean, that we had an...
They're using this whole Arab
sure.
scare to, you know, say, see, we told you they're all terrorists.
Right. No, they are. I mean, you know, and they have been using the, I mean, it's the Palestinians are the terrorists because they throw rocks and have a bomb, you know, and then the Israelis aren't terrorists if they go and do something. But I mean, it's just a manipulable word. I mean, everybody uses violence up at that level of control. Everybody kills civilians. The number of civilians in World War I killed was 4%. World War II goes up about 25%. Korea, you're up to 56%. Vietnam, you're up to 95%. When you're up to 95% civilian death in a war, what's the collateral damage? It's the combatant deaths. And it has to do with the weapons and the way they fight the wars. But, I mean, these are wars against civilians. What are the weapons they use? I mean, the weapons are anti-personnel weapons. They drop all those cluster bombs, you know, and they go down and they explode. And they don't penetrate a tank tire. They don't penetrate a sandbag. The only thing they go through is human flesh. And the Vietnamese started to get good at least at x-raying them and then going in and, you know, getting them out of the places where they were restricting the blood flow. You know what they did? Honeywell started making them out of plastic. That's how they solved that problem, so that they were lethal, you know. And their weapons, they talked to a guy that drives the hospital supplies throughout Afghanistan to the different hospitals for one of the companies, and he said the people in the hospitals after the bombing are women and children. Well, you're already 80%, 85% women or children in Afghanistan because the males all got wiped out in the previous war. You know, you're bombing this country. I mean, they're throwing these bombs into these caves. It was NATO and the CIA that built those caves as part of the operation to hide them, you know, so that they could fight the Soviet Union. So they may just be going in and bombing places to obliterate the evidence of their involvement in the scam in the first place.
Seems to me that educating people is the only way to get out of this. I mean, it's the only way to bring them down. But how do we go about educating people so we can bring this fascism down to its knees? You know, when the propaganda machine is huge and we are just individuals talking to other individuals, it seems to me that it's a, you know, there's got to be some key here that I am missing.
I don't think that. Certainly they have control of a great deal of media and propaganda. But I don't think that should make you feel defeatist, I mean, about it. I think that it's a challenge, of course, because of the disinformation that's coming out. But also remember, I mean, as hard as they've tried to tell you that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy by himself, they still can't get a poll down below about 95% of the American people who believe it. Okay? I mean, talking among ourselves is really all we have. And it's better for us to talk among ourselves, I believe, and establish the democracy from the bottom up than to rely on getting a hold of some kind of or influencing some kind of power that's centralized at the top. I mean, what I've been suggesting, because there were people after, you know, September 11th, you know, like big numbers go out in the street and demonstrate. Well, it's okay to be visible, but ultimately you demonstrate and you march around in front of the White House, what are you doing? I mean, you're begging these people that are already in power that they're going to change their mind about something that they've already gotten the planning?
There was a mass movement around the Vietnam War that helped end that, along with what happened, you know, in the army itself.
Yes,
right?
But what happened in the army itself was, in fact, more telling, you know, and the ultimate defeat was that the troops themselves began to respond, you know.
But that was facilitated by the enemy.
I'm not saying it wasn't interconnected, but what I'm saying is the general view of centralists is if we can just get, it's kind of spray paint organizing. If we could go in with a can of spray paint and paint everybody else the same color as us, then we can win if we get enough of them on our side. I don't think that's the right organizing model. I'm not a centralist. I don't believe in organizing some big political party. I don't see anything wrong in being visible, but being visible and marching around in a circle is not organizing. Organizing for the Vietnam War did not start with huge marches. It started with information tables. It started at the local level, and I think that's what we have to do. If we have 200 people in a room who want to do something about this, rather than start an organization among those 200 people and fight over the you know, what they call the you know, the principles of unity is what the leftists like to call it, you know, what I call the unprincipled disunity, to try to make everybody agree on some kind of obscure political points, you know. I mean, we don't have to find out what the principles of unity of everybody in a room or everybody in a city that wanted to organize against the war. We're already awake. It doesn't matter what our principles of unity are. The only thing that matters is could we come up with principles and statements that speak to the values of ordinary people that are not in the room and that don't already agree. That's who you have to unify with, not each other. You have to unify with the people that aren't, you don't know, that you aren't listening to. And you're not going to get those people to come out to your political discussion or march with you in the street for the most part. You're going to have to go to them. So instead of saying, you know, somebody said, well, we got to build this organization and build, bring all these people, it's like, the hell with that. If you've got 100 people in the room, take the 100 people and put them out in 100 other organizations. Put them out in 100 neighborhoods. Put them out in their workplaces. Decentralize it. Start at the lowest level. The smaller the group, the better. And talk as individuals and build up from there. Build your democracy up from there. Well, I mean, there's some people that aren't going to change until objective conditions force them to change. But there's a large majority of the society at this point who don't have a lot of comfort. You know, I mean, the comfort zone doesn't extend as far as it did even when I was growing up. There's a lot more disenfranchised people, and we're in the middle of a recession. More and more people are getting into that place. But I think the key, though, is that you have to, people not only don't know things, but you can know things. See, Martin Schott said in this book, History Will Not Absolve Us, that the political paralysis in America comes from the fact that we're allowed to believe anything, but we're not allowed to know anything. We can believe whatever we want. We can believe aliens in a flying saucer, whatever we want, but we're not allowed to know anything. And until you can know something, you can't act. You can't make a responsible decision without knowing. But the second part of that is, even when we know that something's wrong, if we don't have any mechanism to make a decision or to influence things, if all we're going to do is use their mechanism that they've already set up and they've already waited, I mean, it's like, I don't vote, all right? I don't vote, it's just a matter of principle with me. You know, I used to wear a button that said, don't vote, it only encourages them. You know, I had another button that said, if voting worked, it would be illegal. Okay, and I don't vote because to me, I call it the evil of two lessers. Okay, I mean, there's nothing out there to vote for. No, well, an issue or a referendum, I would vote on an issue, but I'm talking about a elected representative. I don't vote for elected representatives. The only time I ever registered to vote was they were going to recall Rizzo. And I could vote on a recall, because I'm more than willing to take people out of office. But then the state Supreme Court said that we didn't have the constitutional right to vote on a recall, and they overturned it, you know. But that was the only time I ever voted, you know. And plus, I'm not going to be any good on jury duty anyway, because I don't believe the cops. So, you know, I don't vote, but... You know, I think that you can plant, you can seed ideas about a democratic process or a structure, but also you have to have some kind of a vision of what you want. You have to be able to envision the time that you're in and what your liberation might look like, and you have to do that not just locally, but also globally. And you have to have some idea of like, you know, well just, I mean, or if Gore got elected, would you be sitting back down? Or do you realize that you're at a crossroads in human history? That you've got basically two paths out in front of you. You've got you are where the German people were in September of 1939. Poland has been invaded. World War II and the Holocaust genocide are looming. You are the German people. Are you going to do this or are you going to do this? That's your choice now. And the American people are the last ones left to make that choice. We are the only enemy that this growing fascist corporate state has. We're the ones that they work the most to uneducate and to disenfranchise because they're afraid of us.
Do you think that's why they're
We can go in the room?
We can go in the room now.
Okay.